proceed to the next case, which is the United States versus Richard Weigel. Mr. William?
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Stephen Williams. I represent the defendant, Bernard Weigel, in this case. I think the threshold issue that needs to be discussed here is whether or not the lower court considered Mr. Weigel's pre-arrest silence merely as evidence that went to impeachment or whether it was substantive evidence of his guilt. Looking at the lower court statements that were orally expressed at the end of the hearing, it's clear that the lower court intended for this evidence to be used, or at least had used it, for substantive guilt.
Can I ask you a question, Mr. Williams? I haven't looked at every one of the cases you cited, but most of the cases you cite in your brief about the way that this kind of testimony can be used come from the context of an original criminal trial, not from the context of revocation of supervised release. And there clearly are some procedural differences between the two. For example, as we know, the preponderance of the evidence standard as opposed to the reasonable doubt standard. What about this? Is this the kind of thing where we should simply assume that the rule from the general criminal procedure carries over, or is there some reason to give district court judges more leeway?
Well, I think the district court judges are given more leeway with respect to the standard in terms of preponderance of the evidence. But
right.
With respect to whether or not the constitutional protections apply, I don't think we should give them more deference unless
those protections. So it's a reasonable doubt standard. That's a constitutional protection. So I guess what you have to be saying is things like the Fifth Amendment and the Fourth Amendment, although we know that the Fourth Amendment actually operates somewhat differently in this context as well, which is why I'm asking the question.
I think in this particular case, and I understand Your Honor's question, with respect to this type of an offense as it relates to a violation of a condition of probation, because here we are talking about the violation of state or federal law, Mr. Weigel has to be allowed to continue to retain those protections within the context of those proceedings.
But wouldn't it be enough if, should the state in this instance, it's a state law violation in this particular case, if it had chosen to do something about this alleged battery, it would have been under the constraints that the Fifth Amendment places on evidence in trials, and its use of pre-arrest silence would have been restricted. I just don't know. I mean, I think it's an important point here because, in fact, when he is sentenced for the revocation of the supervised release, there's been a fair amount of law from the Supreme Court and this court about the constraints on how much more of a sentence can be imposed on somebody. This district judge stays exactly within what the limits of the original sentence were. So I don't know. It concerns me.
Well, if I can respond further to that question,
mm-hmm.
I think another way of looking at this is under what circumstances are we going to allow someone's probation to be revoked for an allegation? In this particular case, there were two things that the lower court relied on, one of which was the fact that Mr. Weigel had a conviction, that conviction being the very same that he was on probation for. The second of which was,
well, in a credibility sense, the judge gave a little speech about, I don't think people with convictions are credible, right?
Correct.
Right.
That's how he started off his ruling with, when we talk about credibility, I'm going to look at your credibility with a jaundiced eye.
And in fact, the government says that shows more than anything that the only way he was using the pre-arrest silence was a credibility consideration, which I take it you concede would have been all right.
Certainly. I mean, the law is clear that you can use it for the purposes of credibility, but then the judge went on to say, after talking about the use of things that are acceptable for considering credibility, such as someone's conviction. In this very case, he says, then I look at the facts of the case and make a determination as to whether or not this claim of self-defense is true. Now, in saying that, the lower court was indicating that he is going to look at the facts and circumstances surrounding the case, the evidence surrounding the case, and determine whether or not Mr. Weigel's guilty or innocent. It's the exact same thing, because there was no question that Mr. Weigel had struck his wife.
Well, that's right. In a sense, there's no question that he committed a battery, whether it was, in effect, an excused battery because of self-defense. Who knows? I mean, I that was the issue, but he
certainly
did commit a battery.
Certainly. And then so the sole issue was whether this was done in self-defense. Now, so the fact that his wife was injured is irrelevant, because Mr. Weigel concedes that. The issue is whether or not her injury, his battery, occurred as a justifiable result of a reaction to her biting him, and that was something that was very clear in the record. And the lower court indicated that he couldn't tell what the sequence of events were, because both of the people were obviously very intoxicated at the time this happened. Well, the sequence of events is extremely important to this particular case. The sequence of events is what determines whether or not self-defense is a valid defense or not. Now, what this gets back to is, in light of all of those circumstances, do we give someone the protections of being able to say to themselves, I don't want to go voluntarily talk to the police, as is allowed all of us? Or is that something that we're going to say, if you don't go talk to the police and you're a convicted criminal, if someone makes an accusation that you violated a condition of your probation, you're done. You're going back to prison. And that is why I think, getting back to your original question, Your Honor, why those protections should still apply in the context of a revocation of probation. What essentially was done here is the lower court made a determination that not going to the police, not filing a report, is inconsistent with a claim of innocence, which you cannot do. It goes beyond an examination of examining what the proffered reason was for not doing that, which is allowed, and goes beyond that and says, why didn't he go to the police? Why didn't he file a police report? Why didn't he do something to corroborate his claim? And it does not examine his proffered explanation, which he gave under cross-examination, was, I talked to my probation officer. My probation officer just had told me to find out whether or not I had charges pending. State charges were never issued. Understandably, he felt, well, maybe I better not go down to the police department and make matters worse for myself.
I'm interested in this whole idea of the interplay between the Fifth Amendment and a probation or supervised release revocation proceeding. A judge has a report that a person on supervision has committed a crime, a domestic battery in a case like this. So you bring the defendant into court, and the judge, this is the report I have, what do you have to say? Are you saying that the law is that he can say, I refuse to answer on the grounds that my answer might tend to incriminate me, invoke his Fifth Amendment rights to the judge, and the judge could not revoke his probation based on that report?
No, I think under those circumstances, if you're entering a report into evidence and you have reason to believe that there's reliability for the report, there's nothing to rebut that evidence, and the defendant's chosen not to testify, made that tactical decision, then clearly, under the preponderance of evidence standard, you could revoke that individual's probation. So I think that under those circumstances, that is permissible, Your Honor.
But why, in theory, then, is that so much different than this, the judge saying, well, you know, if you were, I mean, I don't know if the judge said this, but I assume the judge thought about, well, if you really didn't do this, so you had this self-defense theory, why would you, it would be logical for you to have gone to the police station and told them that?
Well, that's exactly what the problem is that's the assumption that was made. It's one thing to, when you have evidence in a, that's contained in a report that goes beyond just this guy didn't say anything to the police. The report contains allegations from a victim. And this, and the defendant doesn't get on the stand and rebut that, versus what the assumption was made here is he doesn't go to the police department, therefore he's guilty. Now, that is something that we do not assume in this country, and we shouldn't assume it for individuals who are under the constraints of probation any more so than anyone else. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Garrison.
May it please the court, my name is Bob Garrison. I'm an assistant United States attorney, and I represented the government at the supervised release hearing, which forms the basis of this appeal. Unless there are questions from the court, which I will be happy to try to address, the United States will stand on its brief. Thank you very much.
Okay, if that's it. Steve, were you, court appointed?
Yes,
I thought so. Thanks very much for taking the assignment.